Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along. It's Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. Thank you for joining me. I'm Justin Brierley. I'll be with you through till 4 p.m. this afternoon on Unbelievable, the programme where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk. And we'll be finding out what's happening on the show today very shortly. Let me say thank you, of course, to Megan for Premier I Choose. And don't forget, the New Look lineup on a Saturday afternoon continues this afternoon. Hip Rock, the new sound of Hip Rock UK with Dave and B coming up between 4 and 6. And Loretta Fenton presents between 6 and 7. Chances for unsigned Christian artists to get their stuff out there, heard in the marketplace. It's a great new show. Do encourage you to listen to that at 6 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you if you listen to us online as well. I know that we have lots of people who get the podcast regularly, so welcome along. All that other stuff won't really apply to you that I just mentioned, but it's great to have you with us anyway, wherever you are listening in the world. And let's find out what's coming up on the show today. You're unbelievable. Well, we're going to be looking at really the central thing about Christianity. Did Jesus rise from the dead? Essentially, the whole of Christianity rests on that whole doctrine, the idea that Jesus, having died, rose again 3 days later. Well, obviously, there's been an awful lot of talk about it over the last 2,000 years, and we're going to be adding to it this afternoon. Joining me on the programme today, we're going to be having Ken Humphreys. Ken is a militant atheist, I suppose you could call him. Doesn't even believe, actually, that Jesus existed. So, you know, certainly doesn't believe in the resurrection. We'll be finding out his specific reasons. He's going to be in conversation this afternoon with Tony Costa. He's an American apologist evangelist. He's going to be explaining why he believes we have good reason to believe in the resurrection. And thank you if you've been responding to some of our past programmes. A number of bits and pieces have come up in the last couple of weeks. I'm still getting your responses into those two programmes we did a couple of weeks ago with John W. Loftus and Peter May. John W. Loftus, of course, the author of Debunking Christianity, a former professed Christian, now an atheist. We heard his story a few weeks back, and he was with us for two programmes, very interesting programmes as well. Let me just, play out some more of what we've been hearing from people on the voicemail in response to those programmes, specifically on John's loss of faith, first of all. Let's hear some of your responses to that again.
Hi, I'm just wondering if your guest in the studio would like to explore the question of whether or not John Loftus was directly targeted by Satan, and if his downfall can be directly attributed to the work of the devil, or if that's perhaps no longer a fashionable belief to to put forward, so perhaps you could maybe discuss that. My name's Craig from Greenock. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Jane. I've just been listening to the programme, and it just sounds to me that the guy John's just really hurting, and he's just trying to argue his way out of his face, but there was just a series of disasters that happened, and the consequences are that he's now, I feel, trying to justify his sin, really, and he's ended up in where he's ended up.
My name is Amaka, calling from South London. So it's really a pity that guy is doing what he's doing. It's one thing not to believe in a faith, but to go out and destroy that faith, you know, simply because you no longer believe in it, I think is terrible. And I have news for this guy. He says he wants to destroy the Christian faith. He can never do that. You know, the fact that he has blogs on the internet, it's just impossible. The Christian faith will continue to spread, whether he's had a bad experience or not. Thank you.
Thanks for all of the comments. Again, they'll be sent on to our guests from those programmes. And here's another one, specifically in response to last week when we were talking, or the week before last, I apologise, when we were talking with John and Peter about the whole idea of whether people, you know, can believe something because they were born into a particular society, place, area, time, or whether it really is God acting, if you like, when people choose to become a Christian. Ed Bonds in Calgary in Canada says, once again, a very good show. I'd just like to bring out a few points which relate to John, your agnostic guest, you've said, interestingly. It seems like his main premise is always to relate back to his rationalistic view of the world. Statements such as people don't raise up from the dead that John mentions would basically put him in charge of the universe, stating physical bounds are placed on things which he may observe and cannot explain. Paul states that we now look through a glass darkly, but then face to face. He recognised there are things that he does not understand at this present time, even though he was caught up into the third heaven. The bridge between rationalism and a truly objective view of worldly events and physical processes is faith. Faith is what truly pleases God. Without it, we cannot please him, and Jesus mentions in Matthew that when the Son of Man returns, shall he find faith? My question to your guest would be, are there world processes that cannot be rationalised? And if so, how does he explain them? John, there is something much bigger than ourselves, and it seems like your present stand is a result of your decision based upon a personal incident which now seems to shape your worldview. You are heading down a different path, but that does not mean you are destined to continue down this path. You may not feel this at the present time, but let me encourage you that objectively, 1, God exists, and 2, he still loves you, 3, he died to reconcile you to himself. We can try to convince ourselves otherwise, but objectively, it cannot be disproved. John, think back to when you first encountered God, and don't let any subsequent events discolour that event. Allow him back on the throne of your heart, and let him encourage you once again. I'll be praying for you. Thank you for your email, Ed. If you want to get in touch with the show today, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll be giving out the number to call a little bit later on in the show as well. Like these people called, this is responding to some of the various things that John brought up, particularly on choosing religion. This is what Obi had to say.
Yeah, anybody that is so searching and questioning life, questioning their subjects, you know, whatever they're reading out there, or whatever religion, I want to know why and at what age. Because when people are 16 or under, they're living life, you know, doing their own thing, and, you know, young and just looking out. So at what point do all these scientists and all these great religious teachers, at what point do they begin to delve into their own subjects and into their own religion? So much so to now extrapolate and start questioning life itself, you know. Before anybody questions the origin of the universe, the origin of this and that religion, they should question the origin of their own lives. You know, how old are you? 60? 30? And you can't really see beyond your parents. There should be a stop to all these kind of discussions, and it can be a great intellectual exercise, but really, sometimes it can be meaningless.
Thank you very much, Obi, for your call on the programme. Lots of emails are coming in as well on other programmes as well, or just generally interesting ones. Here's one from Gerald. Not sure where you're based, Gerald. I think it must be in another country, New Zealand possibly, or the Netherlands. I'm trying to tell from your internet address, which has a .nl at the end. But you say, "Dear Mr. Brierley, my newest book, called The Unholy Legacy of Abraham, published in the UK in the beginning of March, discusses many of the points you raise in your programme, unbelievable, such as the fraud of the raising of Lazarus, how Jesus was simply saving his own skin by letting the adulterous woman go, how the Bible propagates female subjugation, and many more subjects." And you've given me a press release on that programme and ask, would I be interested in featuring this on this programme? Well, I would be actually, Gerald, because this is where, obviously, we have those kind of objections put to the test with a Christian guest. So I'll get in touch with you. And Gerald, you're obviously among the many atheists who do listen to this programme. And you're welcome. I do hope you enjoy our programme today. Speaking of atheists listening to the programme, there's been a very healthy sort of commentary going on the programmes we've had with John W. Loftus over the last couple of weeks on his blog, Debunking Christianity. If you want to find out where that is, it's debunkingchristianity.blogspot.com. If you scroll back down over the blog, you'll see an entry where he said, "I'm going to be interviewed on Premier Christian Radio." And it's just interesting to see some of the various things that obviously the mainly atheists who write on your blog have been saying in response to their listening to the programme as well. So it's an amazing thing, the internet, isn't it? Just a couple of other programmes, though, that I wanted to draw attention to. This one is from Raymond Bacon. You are responding to the programme back in February, where we had a creationist and an atheist on, talking about creationism. We also had someone who was a theistic evolutionist as well, represented on the programme. And you say you received a recording from the creation science movement in Portsmouth, and you feel it wasn't fair to have three persons against the one creationist, Dr. Rosevere. The result was he couldn't develop any real theme as evidence, so the net result was against Dr. Rosevere, and therefore against the truth of the Bible not being regarded as a fable in regard to Noah's flood. I believe when you start to interpret fossil evidence, etc., as if you believe in the flood, it all starts to fall nicely into place in so many ways. Theistic evolution is probably worst of all, as it seduces real Christians. Why do people want to believe evolution? And you've put two question marks and then another after the word why. No proven true science disproves the Bible. Thank you for your email. This was written on notepaper. It was sent to me in the post. Thank you, Raymond, for your letter. And if you want to listen to that programme again, it's on the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's the place to go for all kinds of interesting discussions we've had from ages past, really, on all sorts of different themes, including that creation theme that we had back in February. Ron Murphy responding to the programme on Sharia law we had, again, a month or two back. That was, of course, in response to when the Archbishop of Canterbury was making some slightly controversial, or was being reported at least to have made controversial statements regarding whether Sharia law should be brought in alongside British law. Now, here's Ron. He says he's a new listener. You say, "Hope you don't mind me coming to the broadcast on Sharia law late, but I've only recently come to your site. Just so you know where I'm coming from, I'm not an absolute atheist, in that the existence of any God is a matter of speculation, but I guess I am in practice an atheist, and I don't mind being labelled as such when it comes to disputing the certainty with which many believers hold their views. But I do favour a secular society where there is tolerance of any religious view. As made clear in your programme, Islam is a whole life system, which includes laws and politics. From my discussions with some Muslims, it's clear that this view is primary, and that the only reason Britain isn't an Islamic Ummah is that it hasn't so far been possible to bring that about. Catherine Heseltine's views, as expressed on your programme, were limited to the fairly tame aspects of Sharia. Abdul Haq was concerned that penal law is usually the focus. The reason is that this is the contentious part that is most disagreeable to a democratic society. I thought Abdul Haq's comment on the rape case was very telling. He saw no irony in his praise of the Nigerian clerics in their call for the death sentence for the rapist. It's on a par with the banners calling for the death of those who call Islam extreme during the cartoon demonstrations. Muslim spokesmen should be challenged on the more contentious points, such as the requirement for the death penalty for apostates or blasphemers. The response is typically that, oh well, that won't happen here anyway. These punishments aren't called for in the Quran. These are bogus claims. It would happen here if only Islam had sufficient following. The Quran is very vague and is open to interpretation, but that interpretation should only be performed by appropriately trained clerics who interpret not only the Quran, but also the teachings of Muhammad. This is where the problem lies. Catherine Heseltine's point that there is no church, that Islam works by mutual consultation, is incorrect. It works by the consent of the clerics. I've no problem with a person's religion informing their morality. I don't have a problem with anyone of faith holding any position in British society. But I do object to anyone's religious views being institutionalised in the running of the state or the making of laws. And you go on to give some examples as well. Thank you, Ron. Good to have you listening. Thanks for those views. I'll try to forward those on as well to the guests on those programmes. Once again, if you want to listen back to any of these past programmes we've been looking at, hearing back your feedback from, do go to the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Why not get hold of the podcast? Lots of people doing it that way these days. Currently, the most popular podcast from the Premier website, the Unbelievable Podcast. Do check it out. Go to the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable and you'll find the instructions of how you can download that on a regular basis. But equally, you can listen online there to all sorts of programmes from last week's to the distant past. Thanks for getting in touch. Loads and loads of emails, as I say, over the last couple of weeks. So sorry if I haven't been able to bring yours or your particular voicemail message hasn't been able to air. We do our best here on the programme. Right, we're going to be meeting our guests shortly as we discuss the resurrection. You may have noticed Connecting with Culture hasn't been around for the last couple of weeks. Hopefully be back again next week, just taking a little break for a couple of weeks. But I'm sure the Institute for Contemporary Christianity will be back with us very shortly. Let's meet our guests for the programme today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And I'm joined on the programme today by Ken Humphreys. Ken was a guest on this programme in a live studio format, getting on for 2 years ago, something like that. It seems a long time ago anyway. Ken is an atheist, and on the previous occasion he was with us, he was talking about really what is, you know, pretty much what he does, at least certainly with his spare time. It's a project called Jesus Never Existed. It exists as a website, as a book, and it's really what Ken devotes a lot of his time to, his claim that Jesus never actually existed. And we had a debate on that. Well, we're sort of not quite looking at that area, but in a very similar kind of way, we're asking the question, did Jesus rise from the dead? And Ken is obviously going to be disputing that idea on the programme today. Backing up that idea, bringing evidence for the idea that Jesus rose from the dead, is Tony Costa today, Canadian evangelist and apologist. He's got a ministry out there in Canada, and he regularly speaks on these kinds of subjects. So let's meet our guests on the programme today. First of all, a warm welcome to you, Ken. Thank very much for being with me today.
It's a pleasure, Justin. It's good to be back with you. And
it's been too long.
Too long, yes.
Though I think you did contribute once by phone to a debate not so long ago.
But that is in fact the case, yeah, about 3 or 4 months ago, yeah.
And it's great to have you on again. Now, the website, Jesus Never Existed, that pretty much says it all in a way, doesn't it?
But it says it all, and it says it at great length, I have to say. It's as someone said to me, it's a larger website than NASA, so...
It's got a wealth of information on there. Certainly, it's a very challenging read. I've been through various articles on it, and you make the claim that Jesus was, in fact, just a hodgepodge of mythical fables and things, and really there's nothing to suggest that he ever actually really was a physical human person that all these stories talk about.
That is indeed my position. Syncretic, I think you'll remember, yes, is my favourite word there.
Right. Take us back a bit, though, Ken. Did you ever have any religious beliefs as a child or anything like that?
Well, you know, it's interesting to say this. I have never had religious belief. And it's always of interest to discover that so many people in the field who are now active atheists are former believers. Mm. It seems to put me in something of a minority group there. No, I've never had religious belief. I grew up in an irreligious background, in an irreligious culture, and but paradoxically, I was fascinated by this pattern of belief that goes as the name of religion. So I've had the interest always, but never the belief.
And so what's actually led you down this path of really trying to, well, debunk, I suppose, the whole idea of Christianity and Jesus? I mean, because on one level, you know, as we had a couple of weeks ago, an atheist guest who does just that, his kind of motivation was that he was a Christian, and so he felt he'd wasted his time by being a Christian. I mean, what's your driving motivation for trying to, as it were, defuse the Christian faith in this way?
Okay, I do see religion, and not just Christianity, religion as a clear and present danger. I do see that. I do think it is necessary to rebut and answer some of the claims of religion, because we live in a world in which there is a new a dynamic to religious belief, and it does have a rather threatening side to it. So there is that more immediate issue. Beyond that, as an academic topic, it's always intrigued me. You know, there is a great mystery there in terms of understanding the evolution of religion, and that's one that continues to fascinate me. It's worth saying that because it's sometimes thought of me that I might be embittered by bad experiences with Christians, and I have to confess, I was never molested as a choir boy. You know, I was never led astray up dark alleys by people in dog collars. No, it's simply that there is something fascinating about religious belief, and particularly when it makes such bold claims, such as rising from the dead. These are claims that you would think one can easily respond to, and I think it's worth tackling those issues, and that's what I continue to do. And I find it's an endless topic. I mean,
absolutely. And we're going to be hearing your reasons for particularly why you would contest this idea that Jesus rose from the dead. It is, if you like, foundational. Well, in my mind, at least, it's foundational to the Christian faith, the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. And so, if you were able to, in some, you know, to disprove that, then I think you would disprove Christianity fundamentally, and I think Tony Costa, our guest, would probably agree with that. Let's speak to Tony now. Tony, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Justin. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's lovely to have you. You're hail from Canada.
Yes, from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, yes.
Fantastic. And tell me, Tony, your story. Have you sort of had faith from an early age yourself?
Yes, I was born in a Portuguese family. I come from a Portuguese background, and I was born in a Roman Catholic family that was very devout, very religious. And I grew in that environment, and I shared that type of religious conviction. But the problem with me, Justin, was I really never had this confidence in what I believed. I know what I believed, but I didn't know why I believed what I believed. Mm. And I would say at my teenage years, I went on a spiritual quest to try to figure out what exactly is this faith that is called Christianity. I came to have a what I would call, I guess, a religious experience at that age in which I came in contact with this person called Jesus of Nazareth, and I believe that he changed my life and radically changed my life, but it didn't end there. It prompted me to go on a quest. I pursued higher education. I obtained a bachelor's and a master's degree from the University of Toronto in Religious Studies and New Testament, and I'm currently now doing a PhD through the University of Pretoria in South Africa in New Testament Studies. And I've dedicated my life basically to figuring out and finding the foundations of my faith. And what I have found in particular was that when I went into the resurrection, the study of the resurrection, because as you pointed out quite rightly, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, then really Christianity has no substance to it. And so that has been my particular area of interest, is resurrection study. And what I have found is quite remarkable, is that the majority of New Testament scholars and historians do agree on some of the basic points revolving around the resurrection of Jesus as we find in the New Testament. And those are some of the points that I'd like to raise in our discussion today.
Well, we look forward to your contribution, Tony. And, I mean, tell us a bit about what you do out there, because, I mean, you're involved in sort of going to places and talking through the things that you found. I mean, what kind of audiences do you speak to, and are they receptive to the message you bring?
Yes. Well, first of all, I'm also an ordained minister. I am a minister of the gospel, and I work in the capacity of a pastor. But I also have an academic interest in which I do lectures at universities, at various colleges. I speak at various seminaries on these very topics. I have engaged in public forums and debates with Muslims and people of other faiths and atheists, people who challenge the claims of Christianity, particularly that of the resurrection. And so it's quite a thrilling career to engage students on the academic level.
It sounds like you get excited by the kind of the cut and thrust of it in a way, almost in the, I'm sure, the same way that Ken does, but from the opposite side. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is fair to say. But I think it's important. I agree with Ken that we have to discuss these issues. These issues should be discussed in a public forum. And I think it's important that we do discuss this. We all too often regulate faith to the realm of the unknown and the unprovable. And I think there's a lot to say about the resurrection of Jesus that I think it does bear up to scrutiny.
Well, we'll go into this in more detail as the show progresses this afternoon. And if you're listening and would like to put a point of view across yourself, you're more than welcome to leave us a voicemail message. I'm happy to play that out on next week's program. I always send them on to our guests as well, so they'll be able to hear your comments and questions too. The voicemail number, if you'd like to leave me a message, 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. And if you'd like to email, that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Well, we're going to be talking about the resurrection this afternoon. Easter, of course, was about a month ago now, but hey, it's not going to stop us talking about it, because ultimately this is a doctrine absolutely essential to Christians the world over. Did Jesus really rise from the dead? We're going to be hearing why Tony, our Canadian evangelist, apologist, pastor, which is a rather long title, really, but I'm sure he's happy to go under just the title Tony. He's going to be telling us why he really does firmly believe Jesus actually rose from the dead. And Ken Humphreys is going to be, asking the tough questions of Tony, really. That's why we've brought him in here, to see whether Tony's theories, what he's saying, really stand up to scrutiny. So we'll be doing that during the course of the...
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you. I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Do hope you can stay with us through till 4 o'clock.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Good afternoon. This is the show where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk. In the course of the week here on Premier Christian Radio, there aren't many forums, actually, for Christians and non-Christians to talk. Mostly it's Christians talking to Christians about Christian things. But I like to think that this is the show where we kind of break down some of those barriers and we talk about some of the important things about faith and belief. Now, what could be more central to Christian belief than the resurrection of Jesus Christ? It's something that many people have spent many years talking about. In 2,000 years, it still stands as the ultimate, if you like, stumbling block or foundation block for Christians, or stumbling block for those who deny that Jesus rose from the dead. It is the ultimate miracle. It's the thing that many people would say is foundational to belief in Jesus as the Son of God, the idea that Jesus really was God in human flesh, to be able to say that he rose from the dead. Well, we're going to be hearing from Tony Costa. He's a Canadian. He's with us on the line this afternoon as he explains why in his academic and Christian life he has come to truly believe that there is outstanding evidence for the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. It's obviously a faith thing, but it's not just blind faith. Tony's going to be telling us why he believes we can really stand firm on the proposition that Jesus did rise from death. Against him, Ken Humphreys. He's our UK atheist, and he's the author of the book Jesus Never Existed and the website of the same name. Obviously, you can probably tell from the title, he holds a certain view about Jesus, i.e. that he didn't even exist. So, you know, how on earth would the resurrection have taken place? But he's going to specifically be tackling some of Tony's statements on the programme today. I think we're in for a really interesting ride here on Unbelievable. Don't usually get to the end of the music. There you go. It must have been a very long intro. Okay. Tony, thank you again for coming on. Tell us, like, maybe to start with, where are the key things that we should know when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus? If someone came to you and said, you know, believing in Jesus rising from the dead, you know, it's a leap of faith, you know, I can believe maybe Jesus died on the cross, but surely believing in someone rising from the dead, that's just a whole nother ball game, isn't it?
It certainly is, and that's because on a natural level, of course, no one would presuppose that the dead can rise, but the consistent claim of the New Testament writers was that it was God who raised Jesus from the dead. So the New Testament writers acknowledge the fact that this was no natural event. This is not something that is an everyday occurrence, that this was a supernatural act of God in raising Jesus from the dead. And furthermore, I think it's important to realize that even in St. Paul's writings in 1 Corinthians 15, and St. Paul is the earliest New Testament writer, and 1 Corinthians was written about 20 years after the death of Jesus, even St. Paul tells us that if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless and so is your faith. And in fact, he tells us that if Christ has not been raised, he says, you are to be pitied above all people. He doesn't commend people for believing a lie. He actually says you should be pitied if you believe that Jesus did not rise from the dead. So I think St. Paul himself realizes that if Christ did not rise from the dead, then Christianity is really a hoax. It's a fraud.
Hmm. Ken, you've actually not long ago debated this very subject with Gary Habermas, who is seen in the world as one of the authorities on
a world, the resurrection. A world specialist on the resurrection, I think, yeah. Your question?
Oh, well, I was going to say, firstly, did you enjoy that debate?
Oh, absolutely.
I didn't get a chance to ask you before. It was in front of a student audience, was that right?
Well, student and others of approximately 1,000, I would thought, at the University of Edinburgh, yes.
Fantastic. And obviously you would have gone over the arguments, presumably. What was your main contention then yourself against the resurrection?
Well, against the resurrection, of course, Tony has already conceded it offends natural law. Mm. But I'm not going to be pedantic about that, because if we suppose a God, we can suppose that God can resurrect people. So that is perfectly consistent. All I would say, of course, if such an extraordinary and unusual, if you like, unique event had occurred, we need really good evidence. And the consistent claims of New Testament writers, well, it's some sort of evidence, but equally it could simply be the musings of fiction writers and have no evidential value at all. So that is the problem.
Okay. So you're saying we need really rock tight, you know.
Well, yes, we're not debating, you know, the colour of oranges. We are saying something here which offends every principle of natural law. It needs really good evidence, yes.
Okay, so Tony, that's the challenge, I suppose. You've got to have really good evidence if you're going to claim this as being true.
Yeah.
How good is your evidence?
Well, I definitely agree with Ken that he's absolutely right, that if God exists, then the dead, then the idea of God raising the dead is definitely possible. If he does not exist, then we have a very difficult time trying to prove that. But by way of evidence, what I would say is that all we do have right now is historical documents that we go by. And what is significant here, Justin, is the fact that most critical historians and scholars, and some of them are very radical critics of the New Testament, concede that there are five basic points that we can know about the historical Jesus. And some of these radical critics are atheists themselves. I don't know, would you like me to enumerate them at this point?
Well, if it helps, feel free to do that.
Well, what I just want to point out is, if I can just quote, for instance, Bart Ehrman, who is considered quite a radical New Testament scholar. Bart Ehrman says, quote, "It is a historical fact that some of Jesus' followers came to believe that he had been raised from the dead soon after his execution." And the late Raymond Brown pointed out that historically Jesus' death was the most public moment of his life. And there are five basic points that scholars look at when they deal with the historical Jesus. And the five points I'd like to enumerate are the following. The first one is the crucifixion. The second one is the honorable burial of Jesus. The third one is the discovery of the empty tomb. The fourth one is the post-mortem appearances of Jesus. And fifthly, the origin of the Christian way. Now, if we look at the crucifixion, what is surprising is that virtually all scholars, historians and New Testament scholars, concede the fact that the crucifixion of Jesus is an indisputable fact. In fact, the late Robert Funk, who was the chair of the Jesus Seminar, stated that this is the one indisputable fact that we know about the historical Jesus. And this is a fact that is conceded by virtually all scholars, that Jesus died by crucifixion. The second point...
Shall we do that? Because you've enumerated your five points, and so crucifixion obviously is fundamental in establishing that Jesus died. Yes.
Yes. That's the first one.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know that you have problems from the very beginning on most of this, Ken, because you don't even believe Jesus existed. But obviously, we haven't got time to go through through everything that entails. But what's your problem then?
Well, let me just
take
this about the indisputable evidence of crucifixion. We don't actually have that. That is not really what historians say, but they will accept the possibilities of a crucifixion and the fact that we know indisputably crucifixion was a Roman form of execution and torture. So whilst it is not impossible that Jesus was crucified, we don't have actual evidence that particular Jesus that you are referring to in this debate, the Jesus of Nazareth, was crucified. We don't have it that well tied down. We simply have the probabilistic evidence that crucifixion was a form of execution. Nobody else records that event, that it was Jesus of Nazareth.
So why do you dispute the fact, Ken, that it was Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, no, I don't need to dispute the fact that it was. What we're looking for is evidence that it was. Somebody, we don't believe that it is so unless we can disprove it. Surely we need evidence that it was Jesus of Nazareth that was crucified.
Right. But why would these critical historians, some quite radical, like Robert Funk, John Dominic Crossan, Gerd Ludemann, why would these scholars who have no investment in Christianity, why would they concede the fact that this was indeed Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, of course, that would be a debate that would run and run. We would have to discuss scholar by scholar. You've mentioned Bart Ehrman a couple of times. Well, of course, Bart Ehrman was a fundamentalist Christian.
Yes. Yes,
you know, and in the course of his own education and the evolution of his own ideas, he lost his faith. So, you know, but we could take each. We obviously cannot debate the particular perspective of individual Christian scholars, but certainly they are Christian scholars.
Yeah, but Ken, Ehrman does not claim any roots. In fact, he says he's lost faith. My whole point is, why is it that all of these scholars across this this scope. Why do these scholars all come to the agreement that Jesus of Nazareth died by crucifixion?
Okay, but what you're claiming there is simply a consensus of New Testament scholars.
Oh no! I'm not arguing by consensus. I'm arguing here that the overwhelming number of scholars from diverse backgrounds and academic fields, historians and New Testament scholars, have come to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth was put to death by crucifixion.
Okay, I'll give you a brief answer to that question.
Yeah, what has led them to that conclusion?
The problem we have with New Testament scholarship is that it has been historically dominated by Christians who have been drawn into a study of their faith. Now, whether along the way they have lost their faith or not, nonetheless, these colleges of Christianity and the universities of Christianity pour out a huge number of students, and of course, most New Testament scholars today still have some affection for the traditional Christianity that they grew up with.
I think we're dodging the question here. The question here is, what is the criteria that these scholars are using to come to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth died on the cross? What has led them to that conclusion?
I'd say it's the historical faith that they grew up with and the probabilistic chances that for them it was true. It is not a clear-cut case. Each one would have to be looked at individually.
You don't believe the internal evidence in the New Testament documents and the external evidence in Greco-Roman Jewish literature has not convinced these scholars that Jesus died on the cross?
I'm sure they've used those sources, but we can all look at the same evidence and reach different conclusions.
Obviously, in this case, you have reached a different conclusion, Ken, but I think for the purposes of our discussion today, we're in a sense going to have to put that discussion to one side. Sure. Obviously, Tony believes it's incontrovertible that Jesus died, and as he's stated, you know, there's not many scholars out there, and in a sense, yours as a whole, that Jesus never existed, is a kind of minority view.
But we respect that.
You know, you hold that view. However, moving on to your other four points there, Tony.
Yeah.
Jesus was buried.
Well, the honorable burial of Jesus is crucial, because what the honorable burial of Jesus tells us is that the location of the tomb of Jesus was known to both enemy and friend alike. If I can just quote the late John A.T. Robinson, who was a professor at Cambridge University there in England, he tells us that the honorable burial of Jesus is, quote, one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus, close quote. And I think this is significant, because what it tells us is that the burial place of Jesus was known. In other words, when the women disciples went to the tomb, they did not go to a different tomb. They didn't go to the wrong tomb. They knew where he was laid. And therefore, this leads us to the next discovery, and that is the discovery of the empty tomb, because the empty tomb discovery is, again, essential to the premise of the resurrection.
Now, for you, Ken, is all of this a moot point? Because you believe that these very documents that speak of women turning up at an empty tomb, etc., are themselves invalid. Is that the case?
No, not invalid, and it is my intention to be charitable to the case that will be put here. So let's see how far we can accommodate that without taking that sort of extreme position. Now, but we have points two and three here, the honourable burial and the empty tomb. Now, if we are looking for, as we agreed, pretty good evidence, damn good evidence for what is an extraordinary event by any standards, we have to say, you know, Where is the evidence for these two points, the honourable burial and the empty tomb? And unfortunately, we again have to return to the same limited source. Now, that is a bit of an embarrassment in terms of trying to establish not just a tentative case, but an overwhelming case. That's what we're looking for, something that we can't really argue against. Now, it is interesting, this empty tomb business. It makes me smile now, because, of course, we have at least a choice of three tombs to choose from. I always like to think, which tomb are we actually talking about? Because we have the traditional tomb in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. We have the tomb, the so-called garden tomb north of the Old City, accredited to General Gordon. And now, more recently, we have the third tomb down in East Talbiot that Cameron and company have made a film of. And my only point about that is, look how ambiguous the evidence is that, you know, knowledgeable Christians of all kinds of persuasions can start to locate the tomb wherever they choose. Now, that, for me, as a skeptic, starts me to think, well, how reliable is this written evidence when the physical evidence is so vague?
Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, I would say that the so-called alleged places of the empty tomb that we have today in the Holy Land, I think the discovery of these various sites did really not come into vogue in Christian history until the 4th century, in the time of Constantine and his mother Helena, of course, going out in pilgrimages, and this is when really Christian pilgrimages really took off. But what I would say in response to Ken there is, first of all, the empty tomb tradition, again, the evidence that is found for it is found actually in multiple sources within the New Testament documents. That is to say that...
Can I interrupt just a second there, Tony? So, in a sense, you are agreeing that the so-called tombs are all pious fabrications?
Absolutely. I don't think that we know for sure, and the reason why, Ken, we don't know for sure is because the tomb of Jesus was not a place of veneration by the early Christians. One thing we do know about early Judaism, first century Judaism, is that they would mark the tombs of holy men and rabbis and prophets, and they would become locations of veneration. The fact that the tomb of Jesus never became a place of veneration, I think, speaks loudly to the fact that the reason why it never became a place of veneration was because it was empty. There was nothing there to venerate.
Okay, I accept your point. Would you also accept that the empty tomb or the absence of a tradition could also logically be consistent with a fabricated story?
Not at all. Again, when scholarship investigates the synoptic accounts and the Johannine account of the empty tomb, it leads them to the conclusion that there is indeed a historical core behind these stories. Let me just add one thing, and that is when we look at the New Testament Gospels, we have to take into account that there are independent sources within those Gospels. Mark is considered the earliest of all the Gospels. That is one source. It is believed that Matthew and Luke used Mark. But also, Matthew and Luke also contain another source that scholars call Q, the Q document. So now we have a second source. We also have the Johannine Gospel, the fourth Gospel, which is also considered an independent source. We have Paul's testimony in 1 Corinthians 15 that Christ died, he was buried, and he was raised, and he appeared. And so, to quote Jacob Kramer, who is an Austrian specialist on the resurrection, he says, quote, "By far, most exegetes hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements concerning the empty tomb." And so, scholars themselves admit that the tomb of Jesus was indeed found empty.
I mean, a question for you, Ken. I mean, when you look at this story, do you have some kind of way that it must have played out for you, that it just kind of developed over time, that a legend developed about an empty tomb and Jesus who rose again? How long would that have taken to develop?
Absolutely, Justin. And of course, Tony has really put us onto that path, whether he intended to or not. In agreeing, as just about every New Testament scholar does, that Mark is the earliest gospel, and also that Matthew and Luke used Mark. Now, that nobody, I don't think, disputes that. Now, how can they, when 95% of Mark is found in Matthew and 65% of Mark is found in Luke? Now, for me, that is so-called witnesses copying the statements of a so-called eyewitness, none of which holds up. You know, that is really less than convincing. We don't have separate testimony here. We have undeniable evidence of later writers copying the work of earlier writers. Now, that is part of, you know, to answer your question, that is demonstrably showing how the story developed, that the authors of Matthew and Luke took Mark's manuscript and added bits to it. Now, okay, I accept Tony's point. One can conceptualize this Q document. That's been done for quite a long while now. Unfortunately, we don't have a copy of it, but it's theoretically very, very likely that it did exist, and so the authors of Matthew and Luke have used a second source. But we're not building up here really evidence of independent testimony or eyewitness testimony. We're building up evidence of the accretion of an ever more elaborate story.
Well, what do you say to that?
I would disagree with that. First of all, as I pointed out earlier, I don't know if Ken's misunderstanding where I'm coming from. Mark is a separate independent source. Yes, Matthew and Luke adopted Mark in various places, but that's not to say that Matthew and Luke themselves, they have their own special material that scholars refer to as M and L, of course. And the Johannine Gospel, the fourth Gospel, is also considered an independent source. It's very different from the Synoptics. Just take a cursory reading of it, you'll notice that immediately. But also, we have forgotten someone else, and that is Paul, the earliest New Testament writer. He also attests to the death, the burial, the empty tomb, the resurrection, the appearances of Jesus to the women. And I think there's an important point here that Ken is missing, and that is, when we look at the gospel accounts of the discovery of the empty tomb, you have women disciples coming to the tomb, which in the first century setting was considered unimaginable to have women who had no legal status, no legal witness whatsoever, bearing witness to the empty tomb of Jesus, was considered just, it's like shooting yourself in the foot. Now, the fact that the gospel writers mentioned the women as the discoverers of the empty tomb, I think, shows that we have a ring of authenticity here.
Well, okay, the point is often made about the testimony of the women. Yes, that's a standard point, I accept. Except that it doesn't end there. Of course, the testimony of women was acceptable when there were no male testimonies. For example, you can find that used by the writer Josephus. He uses female testimony when he's talking about what happened at Masada. So, when push comes to shove, the testimony of women was acceptable.
But isn't the point...
Not in religious matters, Ken. Not in religious matters.
And isn't the point, surely, that if you're claiming it was a fabrication, Ken, they wouldn't have opted for women in the first place? I mean, isn't that the whole point of why women doesn't make sense in that
case? That's exactly it, because if I can just sort of interject here, that's exactly it, Justin, because in the later apocryphal Gospels, lo and behold, who does Jesus appear to? He appears to the men. It's the men who discover Jesus and see him. It's not the women.
Okay, we have to unwrap this to another level, okay? Because, yes, there is a point here that needs answering, right? Now, Tony, you've mentioned a few times now the Apostle Paul and his testimony. Now, if you, as you will know, as I do, 1 Corinthians 15 very well, Paul does not there, in his list of appearances, refer to women.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't. So there's a first anomaly. And if you look at each of the independent gospels, as you call them, you know, there is no consistency in this appearance of women. If you look at the Gospel of Luke, it's more than four. If we look at the Gospel of Mark, it's three. If we look at the Gospel of Matthew, it's two. If we look at the Gospel of John, it's one. And in St. Paul's writings, we have none. Now,
well, let me ask,
how inconsistent can you be?
It's actually quite the other way around, Ken. You raise a very interesting point. The reason why Paul does not mention the women in his Corinthian letter is because he is well aware that his Corinthian community, to whom he is writing, will not accept his testimony. Paul is dealing with skeptics in the Corinthian church. He says in 15 verse 12 that, why do some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? His whole point is a polemic. He's trying to show them that the resurrection of Jesus is true and that it is fundamental to the Christian faith.
All right, let me come back to you on that, Tony. If Paul is being a politician thinking on his feet, you know, can you still maintain that this creed is this early document passed on by the apostles? You know, are you saying that he's modified the documents when he gets down to Corinth?
Well, he certainly has modified it in the sense that he's added himself to it. He's added his own experience of meeting the risen Christ.
And taken the women out.
But he leaves the women out deliberately because of his Corinthian audience. He's well aware that they would dispute him on that fact, on that point, because as in Judaism, so in Corinth, women had no legal standing as witnesses.
So that does suggest we have to start viewing these documents with an awareness of political realities.
Well, we have to put them in their cultural context. They did not come out of a vacuum.
Okay.
They were written in a certain time, a certain context, and we must be sensitive to that culture.
Okay, it does rather weaken the basis on which we're claiming, you know, incontrovertible evidence, if that's so.
I don't think so at all. I think that the fact that we have independent witnesses, independent sources, attesting to this historical core that is, of the death of Jesus, of his burial, of his resurrection, of his appearances, I think is what has led scholars to believe that these things do have a historical core behind them.
Given also, if I could, as it were, add to what Tony's saying, Ken, some say that Paul, being so close, if you like, in time to these writings, to the Corinthians, etc., to the death and resurrection of Jesus, shows that this was not some kind of idea that developed over some time, became legendary, etc. This was something that Christians were talking about, saying was part of their creedal faith from the very earliest times. And so it seems a very short time in which this legend must have had to have sprung up compared to the normal time that legends do tend to do that.
Okay, a response to that. Whether this statement in 1 Corinthians 15 is a creedal statement, well, I will accept that. It certainly reads that way. It does seem as if it's a creedal statement. And why I would say it certainly looks that way in particular is because the verses that lead into that statement and the ones that lead out from it follow fairly consistently. In other words, you could take that creedal statement out and the document still reads, you know, fairly reasonably. Now, there's an alternative to the idea that this is a very early creedal statement and that it is a later interpolation. And why I would say that's the more likely is because when on earth do you start having creeds? When, I'd say, there is a need to resolve difficulties within the community of Christians.
That's interesting. We're going to allow Tony to pick up on that particular assertion as we go into the next section of our programme, because we're already running out of time in this half of the programme. You're listening to Unbelievable. We're talking about the resurrection. Did it really happen? Atheist Ken Humphreys is with me, and on the line, Tony Costa, evangelist and apologist from Canada, as Tony brings his fundamental central reasons. He's given us, in brief, five key reasons for believing in the resurrection of Jesus. He'll continue to demonstrate those in the coming section of the programme and respond to those comments we've just heard from Ken. Let me remind you, if you'd like to contribute yourself, respond to anything you hear on the programme today, do get in touch by voicemail. That's 08456 52 52 52, or select option 5 there, and you can also email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. This afternoon, we're talking about something absolutely central to Christianity as our atheist and Christian who join me talk about the resurrection of Jesus. Ken Humphreys is the author of Jesus Never Existed. He's been telling us why he doesn't think we should trust the New Testament writers when they say that Jesus really did rise from the dead. And Tony Costa, evangelist and apologist from Canada and a pastor out there, is telling us why he believes we really do have good reasons to believe in the historical authenticity of these documents and what they say about Jesus' resurrection from the dead. Well, before we had to just go to our break there, Tony, Ken was essentially making the point that ultimately this creed that you've been pointing to of Paul's could just as easily have been slipped in by later writers, you know, who wanted to bolster, you know, belief in Jesus a bit. So they've slipped it in a later time, that this creed really never was around at the time of Paul. Any responses to that?
Yes. Well, first of all, the nature of creedal material is something that is indigenous to the Bible. It you can find creeds scattered and littered throughout the Bible. And in fact, one of the most famous creeds is the Shema: "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," found in Deuteronomy 6:4, which was known to every Jew, including Jesus of Nazareth. But the New Testament itself also has creeds within it. One of the earliest creeds was "Jesus is Lord," "Kurios Jesus." And also, in Paul's writings in particular, we do have a number of these creeds, and 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 4, is acknowledged by the majority, the vast majority, again, of scholarship that has investigated this passage. And what has led them to the belief that this is a creed is because if you look at the language, if you are acquainted with the Greek language of the New Testament, the language bears witness to the fact that the way it is structured, the prose structure that it's in, the language that is used, Paul uses a number of what is called hapax legomenon, that is, certain words that he only uses in this particular place that he never uses elsewhere. mention of the third day, for instance. Paul never mentions the third day in relation to the resurrection, except in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-4. He refers to Peter by his Aramaic name as Kepha or Cephas. And so scholars have seen this creed as actually originating within 5 years after the death of Jesus. Look at James D.D. Dunn, who is a well-known scholar there in England. He has argued that creed evolved in the Christian community within a year after Jesus' death. So that is incredibly, incredibly early. And the confession, Jesus is Lord, again, is one of the earliest confessions of the Christian
church. So you've got no truck whatsoever with this idea that this was a legend which grew over years.
Absolutely,
as people added
not.
To it.
In fact, A.N. Sherman White, in his wonderful book, Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament, Professor Sherman White points out that the time gap between the death of Jesus and the writing of the Gospels and of the New Testament materials, he says that it's just too short a time for legend and myth to accrue. And I would refer you to that text. It's a wonderful text.
If I can come in there, I mean, yes, I understand your arguments, Tony. I have heard them before. I don't dispute that this is a creed we are talking about. The issue really is, when did this creed become part of 1 Corinthians?
Right.
Now, unfortunately, we do not have any original documents. We do not have anything written by Paul or his scribe from the first century or whenever they were written. The earliest ones, as you will know, they're at the beginning of the third century, where we have real evidence of these documents. Now,
papyrus.
Absolutely. Now, and that allows plenty of time for the insertion of a creed within an existing document. Now, the issue then becomes, what is the more likely case, the more probabilistic case, that this document was written as is within 5 years, as you say, or 3 years, whatever it is, of the crucifixion, or this creed was entered into the document in order to resolve inter-church conflict? And I'd say the latter is the more probabilistic, because that's precisely the pattern whereby we derive other creeds later on in Christian history, such as the Nicene Creed. It resolved earlier disputes in a definitive way by saying, this is what we believe. Now,
right.
It seems very inconsistent or very unconvincing that this creed, which you accept that Paul is willy-nilly having amends if politics favours that, this creed is early rather than late. I think it's unlikely, particularly because it doesn't even agree with what goes in the Gospels.
Well, I would disagree on that point. First of all, Ken, I think it's important that, again, we have to ask the question, why is it that scholarship, again, we come back to the critical historian, the critical methodology of scholarship, why is it that these scholars, again, concede the point that this passage is very early? Well, as I pointed out earlier, the language that you find within that passage is very un-Pauline. It is not reflective of Paul's writing style. The structure of the creed, it does not align with what we see in Paul elsewhere. And for this reason, a number of scholars have concluded that what we have here is a pre-Pauline creed that comes before.
And why not post-Pauline?
But I'm sorry?
Why would you not say it's post-Pauline?
Well, it can't be post-Pauline because Paul is writing it.
If you believe it to be genuine, yes, of course.
Paul would have to be dead for it to be post-Pauline. But
okay, but somebody else, well, some later scribe, and obviously these documents have been copied, some later scribe could have added that part.
Certainly, but we don't find the textual variance in those two verses you're alluding to. They're clear of variance. But let me just point this out, and that is, you say that there's no parallel to what we find in the Gospels. On the contrary, if you read 1 Corinthians 15, 3-4, that Christ died, was buried, was raised, appeared, what you have there in capsule form is what you find in the Gospels, namely that Jesus died, he was buried, the tomb was empty, he appeared to his disciples and to the women, etc. What you have there really is a capsule form of what you find in the Gospel account.
Well, let's look at that closely then. Paul's statement in 1:15 is that he was seen of Cephas. Well, that's not my reading of what it says in the Gospel of Mark or the Gospel of John, where he's seen Mary Magdalene.
But it is in Luke 24, verse 34, that he appeared to Simon.
I'm going to see if we can move beyond this, gents, because I think we've probably tussled around this 1 Corinthians 15 passage quite a long time now, and we'll have to accept that, you know, for one, it shows that this was something that had been worked out early, and for you it was inserted later, Ken, etc. Let's move on to number four in your list of five here, Tony.
Okay.
The post-mortem appearances, the appearances of Jesus, obviously, that are recorded in the Gospels.
Yeah. Well, as I pointed out, we have the death of Jesus, the burial of Jesus, the discovery of the empty tomb, and the fourth point here is the post-mortem appearances. That is that Jesus appeared to individuals, to groups of people. He appeared to skeptics, to enemies, in different locations, in different situations. And these appearances, whether you want to call them hallucinatory, whatever you want to call them, the fact of the matter is that, again, in critical scholarship, there is an agreement that these disciples did experience appearances of the risen Jesus. Let me just quote quickly Gerd Ludemann, a German scholar, also a member of the Jesus Seminar. He states here, quote, "It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ." And so, again, I alert you to the fact that scholarship keeps asserting historical reliability here, that the Gospels do contain a historical nugget behind them, a core that shows that there was such a thing as appearances.
Hmm.
Tony,
now, where did these appearances come from?
Tony, we should perhaps put to one side this continuous appeal to scholarship. After all, I could quote other scholars, minority group maybe, who nonetheless don't reach those same conclusions. Professor Robert Price, for example, does not subscribe to the same things that you are articulating right now. There are other points of view, but at the end of the day, we have to discuss the arguments themselves rather than simply quote authoritative names.
The reason why I'm appealing to these scholars, Ken, it's not necessarily an appeal to authority here. What I'm trying to show is that, once again, we have a wide range of scholars who are studying the New Testament documents, and Gerd Ludemann is a radical scholar who denies the resurrection of Jesus, but he's willing enough to admit the fact that when you carefully look at the gospel texts themselves, including Paul, you cannot avoid the fact that the disciples did experience something in which they recognized as the risen Jesus appearing to them.
Maybe, or maybe somebody, various scribes have written their holy books with that description as they made them of these characters in their story. I mean, it's rather interesting if we look at the gospel trajectory of how these stories grew. The early interpretation of the disciples was rather different from, and less charitable towards the early the disciples in the early period than towards the later period. You know, in Mark's gospel, they seem to be dullards who can never catch on the point. You know, later on, of course, they are getting the point. So we can see perhaps the evolution of an idea here. Whatever your quoted authorities are saying, you know, that would be my point. You know, there seems to be the evolution of a story here.
Again, when you look at the gospel accounts and the appearances of the risen Jesus, what you find immediately is not this open embraciveness where they accept the appearance of Jesus as genuine. What you find in the gospel accounts are there's genuine doubt. They doubt whether it is him. They think at one point it says they thought he was a ghost. And so I think what you find in the gospel accounts really are true renditions of the experiences of these disciples. They didn't know what to make of this. And so I don't sense that there is this evolution of a myth or a fable taking place here. I think that what the gospel accounts are recounting for us, Ken, is that the followers of Jesus truly did experience what they believed to be real appearances.
Does this link into your fifth point, Tony,
which does.
Is the emergence of the Christian way?
It does, Justin, because all of these points are cumulative. If you take all of these points together, the death of Jesus, the burial, the empty tomb discovery, the post-mortem appearances, they lead incontrovertibly to one conclusion, and that is that this is the origin of the Christian way itself. The Christian faith did not begin with the teachings of Jesus. It did not begin by the life of Jesus. What started the Christian movement off was the proclamation that God raised Jesus from the dead. There is no other origin.
Well, with respect, I think there is. With that chain of logic, we arrive at the point that's rather interesting, in the sense that it is little more than saying the and paraphrasing the earliest defence of Christianity made by the Church Fathers, that Christianity succeeded because of its success. In other words, we have won, we have become the biggest religion, we are the official religion of the Roman Empire. That is itself proof that our foundational doctrines were correct. Yeah. Now, the problem with that logic is that it could be applied equally well to any other successful organisation, including Islam. So the fact that Christianity triumphed is not an argument in favour of its success.
But the problem here, Ken, is I'm not talking about the 4th century, the Edict of Milan. I'm not talking about Constantine here. You're absolutely right. Some of the Church Fathers did argue for triumphalism as evidence of the truthfulness of Christianity. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the first 2 centuries where Christians were being put to death, martyred, simply because they refused to call Caesar Lord. And in fact, they proclaimed that Jesus was Lord, that he was the risen Lord. And so I'm not by any means stretching to the 4th century here. I'm talking about the first few centuries of the Christian era.
And
my point is this too, Ken. I think something fundamental you may be forgetting here, and that is that in the context of first century Judaism, the whole idea of a crucified Messiah, it was something considered oxymoronic. It was a contradiction in terms. The fact that the disciples, the fact that early Christianity actually was a Jewish movement in itself is mind-boggling, because why would any Jew want to believe that their Messiah had been crucified, accursed by God, and proclaim him as the Son of God? It makes no sense, unless something transformative happened.
Indeed. I'll agree. Something very big had to happen to cause Christianity to emerge from the body of main Judaism. And I'll give you what that big thing was. It was 3 major conflicts with the Roman Empire, which led to the destruction of the temple economy, the destruction of traditional Judaism, and the wiping off of Judea off the map of the Roman Empire.
Okay.
That was the cataclysm that gave birth to Christianity, not the birth, I would say.
The problem with that, Ken, is that historically, the problem with that is that Christianity was already a force to be reckoned with prior to AD 70. Christians were already found in Rome before the destruction of the temple. And so I don't think those points are historically verifiable. I don't think they're proven. I don't think any New Testament scholar would agree with that point. I think the fact of the matter is the Christian faith mushroomed because it was open to accepting Gentiles. It was open to accepting them purely on the basis of grace and faith in Christ alone.
Yeah. Tony, you will I think, agree with me that once we move earlier than Constantine and the official religion, we move into an increasingly foggy environment in terms of sources and evidence that we can really trust. The sources get fewer, they get contradictory. We're in a period of church conflict where there's many contending factions, and though there are wild claims made for this period, very few of them can be borne out. One that has particularly attracted my interest for a long while now is this idea of the persecution of early Christians. Now, there are some celebrated cases that we all know, such as the fire in Rome and the rest of it, but really, to substantiate that there was serious wholesale persecution of the early Christians, and therefore somehow their suffering was evidence of the truth of their faith, you know, that whole era is really fraught with problems.
Well, I would say that the amount of evidence we have may not be as numerous as we would have, for instance, for the New Testament documents themselves. But I think when we look at those documents, I mean, for instance, if you look at the letter of Pliny to the Emperor Trajan, he talks about the interrogation of Christians and how he interrogates them, and if they refuse to burn incense to the emperor and confess the emperor as Lord, they're put on trial and then they're summarily executed. I think we're able to glean out of these materials, even if they're not as massive as the early New Testament documents are, I think we're able to glean out of them the fact that there was indeed real persecution.
The letters of Pliny are certainly very interesting,
but
you see, against that, I would have to say we've got like the Church Father Origen in Alexandria, who in the middle of the 3rd century says the number of Christian martyrs is actually very few and can be easily counted. Now, you know, that doesn't, to me, and bear in mind we're trying to look for really convincing evidence, that doesn't, to me, sound like massive whole-scale persecution.
Right, right. But I think we're still, notwithstanding the fact that, yes, Origen does mention that, I think a case can be made that there was, I mean, even the burning of Rome and Nero blaming this on the Christians, I think demonstrates that such persecution did take place. And I think the church fathers should not be just removed completely. I think their testimony on this, I think is also truthful. My whole point is that the early Christian movement got started off based on the confession that God raised Jesus from the dead. And I think you'd have to admit, Ken, whether or not you believe Jesus existed, you have to admit the fact that early Christianity is rooted in those twin events known as the death and the resurrection of Jesus.
It's as one other guest of mine who I've had on the resurrection before has put it, there's a resurrection-shaped hole, if you like, in history, which for him the resurrection explains this the genesis, if you like, of this Christian movement, which was so radically different to its Judaistic roots. We're going to just take a quick break as I let people know the number and the email address if they'd like to respond to anything they're hearing on the programme today. Email me at unbelievable@premier.org.uk. What do you think about some of these arguments that have been flying around in the studio today regarding the resurrection of Jesus? Love to have your thoughts as well. And if you'd want to phone your comment in, 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we're nearing the end of our programme as we've been looking at these 5 points that you brought very helpfully to the table at the beginning there, Tony. And ultimately, your contention is that the idea that this was, if you like, an amalgamation, a kind of ongoing, well, as it's been described by Ken, a sort of evolutionary sort of tale, it doesn't make sense given just how clearly people like Paul believed this story of the resurrection so early on.
Precisely. And also, I think the early dating, I think, mitigates against any idea of a later evolution taking place. And I think A. and Sherton White has settled that point once for all.
Yeah, of course, I would have to say that I do not agree with the early dating. I think Christians began by trying to date their Gospels as close to the crucifixion as possible, and they've never willingly conceded that that wasn't the case. And although it moved the dating of the Gospels and Paul moved later on, it's been shunted back again now. But I don't think that issue is resolved happily at all. I've been trying to date Paul and his epistles for the last few years now, and it gets increasingly more difficult to link Paul into any real history.
I mean, are you saying that we keep coming back to Paul, so it might be worth just going around this once more, but do you believe that Paul didn't believe that Jesus had risen from the dead, Ken? Can that really be...
I believe the author of the several main epistles that we can accredit to someone who may have been called Paul had a certain interpretation of Christ, and that didn't bear much similarity to what later became the gospel, Jesus of Nazareth. There's too many things missing from Paul that should be there if Paul was truly this early first century writer who was closely allied with the classical disciples of Jesus.
What do you say to that, Tony?
Well, first of all, I think a very important element here that has to be mentioned is that the Apostle Paul, who was formerly known as Saul of Tarsus, according to the Acts of the Apostles, the Apostle Paul, by his own admission, was a persecutor of early Christianity. He claimed that he was set out to destroy it, that he was an enemy, an opponent. And what does Paul give as his reason for becoming one of the ones whom we persecuted? He tells us in 1 Corinthians 9:1 that he saw the risen Christ, and therefore he was called to be an apostle. So I think we have to explain also the transition that took place in Paul's life, how he went from a persecutor to an adherent of the very faith he was trying to destroy. And I think, again, I don't know where Ken is heading with the later dating of Paul. I don't know why he's trying to do that, because, again, the majority of New Testament scholarship recognizes Paul as the earliest writer of the New Testament.
Let me respond. I mean, when you look at Paul's epistles, the first thing you discover is this debate that's been going since the last 200 years about which ones are authentic or inauthentic. So there's ambiguity from the word go. But I'll make one simple point regarding Paul. There is no secular reference to Paul at all. Now, that is extraordinary. If he was both this persecutor on behalf of Judaism, then he became the most notorious renegade from Judaism, and then he became the most successful evangelist for Christianity. Strange that there is no secular reference to the man at all.
So are you saying, Ken, that if there is no secular attestation for a singular or a number of documents, that that person is therefore ahistorical?
I'm not saying that, but before I start believing he is, I'd need something more than a pious document.
So if archaeology discovered something that attested to the existence of Paul, would you believe him?
Oh, and if it was bona fide archaeological evidence, absolutely.
Would it lead you to rewrite your book that Jesus did in fact exist?
We're talking of Paul here, we're not talking about Jesus.
But Paul believed in somebody, he called Jesus of Nazareth.
I think he believed in Christ, but...
Whoa, wait a minute,
Does Paul use the word Nazareth?
He doesn't use Nazareth.
No, he doesn't.
He refers to Jesus as Jesus Christos, Christ the Lord.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He does refer to him as Jesus.
But as you know, Tony, I'm not going to quibble, but you know there's a lot of the historical Jesus just isn't found in Paul.
Is it fair, though, to say, Ken, that compared to most scholars, you seem to require far more evidence than most people are happy to have when it comes to historical evidence of 2,000 years ago? You seem to want everybody to be kind of, you know, dated and signed and 10 documents to go along with them to give them authenticity.
Okay.
And maybe it's a bit unfair to ask.
No, you're making a reasonable point there. So let me clarify that. Yes, if we have a single reference in one source to somebody, let's say the freedman of Emperor Claudius being called Pallas, one reference, and I'll accept it's probably true. The problem with accepting Jesus and his merry men on that same basis is that somebody gains. There is an axe to grind here. There is a religion that is built upon this. That's the reason why we have to say we need a little bit more than Paul saying he was a persecutor. You know, that...
We're going to have to draw things to a close here. So, Tony, I'll just allow you to finish up as we bring some final thoughts to us, and we're going to have to leave it here.
Well, I think that Ken has just, in one fell swoop, he's just eradicated most of classical history by that very statement, because there's documentation that mentions people only in one place without further attestation. So I think, in one sense, he's just eradicated all classical history there. I think that the resurrection of Jesus can be accepted today by reasonable minded people, and I think that the basic question here is really one of a worldview. I think what we have here is a clash of worldviews. Ken is proceeding forth from a worldview that there is no God, and therefore, if there is no God, then it follows that there can be no breaks into the natural order of things. There's no miracles. I, on the other hand, hold that there is a God, and I believe that the creator of the universe, if he's able to create the universe, he's able to raise someone from the dead. And so, again, if I can just conclude by reenumerating the points I made earlier, we have the crucifixion of Jesus. We have his honorable burial. We have the discovery of his empty tomb. We have the postmortem appearances of Jesus to his followers. And if we take all these points cumulatively, we come to the conclusion, the undeniable conclusion, that this formed the origin of the Christian way. And this is a point that virtually all scholars agree on.
Thank you so much for joining us on the program today, Tony. Ken, thank you for all your tough questions and just bringing the skeptic's point of view to the program today. And if you want to listen back to this program, send it to a friend, allow someone else to listen. Why not go to our webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. It'll be online in the next couple of days or so. And while you're about it, why not check out the website of Ken, jesusneverexisted.com. And you can also go to Tony's apologetics page. That's at freewebs.com/Tony Costa. Thank you for joining me both on the programme today, gentlemen.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Ken.
It's been a really great, spirited discussion here in the studio. Do join us again at the same time next week here on the programme. You're unbelievable. We'll be bringing you more in the line of a discussion between Christians and non-Christians. Do, as I say, keep checking back on the webpage and do tell your friends about Unbelievable every Saturday, 2:30 till 4 o'clock here on Premier.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.